So this is an opportunity for us to talk about issues concerning meditation or Dharma that we may have on our minds or may not be clear about. So please, I invite you to think about questions that you might have or comments you might like to make. And good morning to you.
Hey,
thank you for coming.
You're taking your time. All set up.
So yes, does anyone have anything they would like to talk about?
Chulitas, I have a question. What do you do in a situation where someone that you barely had any contact with at all, I mean, other than maybe to say good morning to, or, you know, in a work situation where you're giving them something, or, but that person takes a severe dislike to you to the point of being really vicious. But you don't, you really have had almost no contact with them. What do you do in a situation like that?
Okay, so this is a more general situation. What do you do whenever there's somebody that takes a dislike to you? But in the particular situation you're asking about it, I think what you're saying is because you've had hardly any contact, there's really nothing that you know of that you could have done.
Yeah.
So the obvious thing which you might first think of doing is, well, whatever I've done to offend this person, let me try to undo it. It's a lot harder to do in that kind of situation. So what are your thoughts on it? I mean,
I don't know. Do you
have to do something?
Well, I never reacted to the person's tirades. And yeah. Actually, it got to the point where other people were criticizing her for the way she was behaving.
Yeah.
And I wasn't angry with her. I thought that the only thing I could think of was that something has to be bothering her that none of us are aware of. You know, but there was no way for me to help her or to even offer consolation in the situation. So I didn't really know what to do.
Yeah. Well, you're already doing the most important thing, which is you're not reacting, you're not becoming angry, you're not getting into any kind of negative space as a result. So that's the most important thing that you're already doing now. And so really what's left is there anything you can do for this person? That's as much of an answer as I can give you without knowing the details of the situation, is that definitely maintain your own attitude of patience and understanding and compassion and non-enmity. And then if there is any opportunity to ease this person's unhappiness, then do so. And I guess in the meantime, avoid just anything that contributes to it.
That's kind of what it is.
Yeah, it's kind of. But in the more general sense, the same thing would apply. The most important thing is, you know, And this is really every situation you're presented with, exactly the same thing is true. No matter whether it's a good and positive situation or something negative or hurtful or involving something like an angry person, is to look at your own reactions and not get into any sort of unwholesome mental states about it. So that's always the most important thing. And then when it's something that involves somebody else, then comes the compassion, the patience, the understanding, and seeing what there is that you can do one way or another. And sometimes there's not anything that you can do. Sometimes that's just the way it is. And the most you can do is avoid further aggravating the person.
Well, I tried to avoid contact as much as I could because I felt like if just me there is upsetting her, then I don't want to contribute to that.
Right. That you haven't been able to talk to her doesn't seem likely that you will be able to.
No, this was some time ago, but the funny thing was that other people started criticizing her and taking her to task for the way she was treating me.
That is often what happens, especially, like, it doesn't happen if you react. But if you don't react and somebody's like that, that's very, seems to be very commonly the outcome, is that other people say, this doesn't make sense. So, you think of that as being, you know, your respective karmas. You make good karma, she makes bad karma, you get your results, she gets hurt.
But you don't like to see people in pain.
Yes, when you see people in pain, you want to be able to do anything. Yeah.
At least offer consolation. Which in this case, we couldn't do that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes there's nothing you can do about someone's pain, but you can be compassionate and offer consolation.
Yeah.
You know, at least that much.
Although if they see you as the cause of the pain, they were not going to accept your consolation. So, that's about all I can tell you about that. Did anybody have any practice-related questions? Practice that you're doing, how it's going, why you're doing it, what it's supposed to accomplish, why it is or isn't accomplishing that.
What are the jhanas actually intending to accomplish? I know that you go through the stages.
What are the jhanas intending to accomplish?
Yeah, I know you go through the stages of the jhanas, and each one has a different kind of flavor to it.
Yeah.
What is the, why is the progression, how is it supposed to work?
Well, one way to look at those jhanas, those different stages, is that they're like a dissection of the mind. Like their dissection of present moment experience, where you're peeling off successive layers and seeing more deeply into the nature of mind and what's happening in the present moment. So that's the actual structure of the jhanas themselves. Okay. You can enter into jhanas from a lighter or a deeper degree of concentration. Jhana, by the way, is absorption, if you're not familiar with that term. Are you familiar?
No.
Yeah. It's a very powerful, single-pointed absorption with a particular object that allows you to enter into a very unique state of mind. And you can Interjhanas from different degrees of concentration. So there's light jhanas and there's deep jhanas. In the deepest jhanas, the first layer you're peeling off is basically all external sensory awareness, so that all you're dealing with from that point is the mind. And you have a mental object that you're using for your meditation in that first jhana. And because of the absorption itself, there is very strong joy and happiness present, which are two different things, which most people don't recognize as two different things. But one of the things that jhanas do is illustrate to you, by illustrating the way your mind works, you come to understand what's the difference, that just two different things involved in what seems to be a single phenomenon, joy and happiness. Anyway, in the first jhana, you have a mental object, and your attention is doing what you normally do with attention. It is being directed towards that object and being sustained on that object, and it is actually how you enter into the absorption. But the subsequent jhanas, at least in most forms of doing the jhana, you do away with meditation object. And so the next layer that's being peeled off is that layer of conscious, intentional, directed activity. And what it's replaced with is just open, expansive awareness of the mind itself. And if you've heard of a practice called Mahamudra from the Tibetan tradition, actually from the Northern Indian tradition and went into Tibet, but that is the practice of jhana, when you have open, expansive awareness of the mind itself. And in that particular practice, you go ahead and allow thoughts and sensations to reoccur, and then you observe them not as something separate from the mind, but as something that's a part of the mind. You compare the mind to the mind in the absence of these things to the mind in the presence of these things. In the more traditional form, the older form of jhana practice, you just let go of the process of attending to things. You have this open awareness of the mind, and you observe the joy and happiness that are present. And as your understanding of them through observation improves, you're able to let go of the joy, which is a mental state, and have just the happiness. So that's the next level of dissection. And then, as you practice in that level of jhana, then you understand the nature of this feeling of happiness, and you're able to work with it in such a way that you abandon it in favor of a powerful equanimity. And so in the fourth jhana, in this fourth level, you've dissected away all these other things, and now you're in a state of just consciousness of the mind itself, independent of mental states and independent of feelings. As in the sutras, you've gone beyond joy and grief, happiness, and pain and pleasure, joy and grief. And also, this state is predominantly characterized by a brilliant consciousness, self-aware consciousness. The subsequent jhanas continue the process of the dissection of the mind. I probably don't need to go into them in detail, but this is the idea. Now, both in the Mahamudra form of it and in the progressive jhanas form of it, the original question is, what's the purpose of it? So this is what it is. It's this process of dissecting experience and coming to understand its nature and its components, and even being able to work with them, set one thing aside in favor of another. But the purpose of that is insight. So that kind of leaves us to the next question. So what is insight? Well, insight, well, we have ordinary kinds of insights all the time where through cumulative experience of certain kinds, there will dawn a profound understanding that we didn't have before. And it's not at an intellectual level of, oh, if this, then that. Oh, that must be the way this is. It's not that kind of thing. It's just what we normally call insight is a kind of intuitive understanding that suddenly arises from a very deep place. And because it's of its intuitive nature, because it comes from a deep place, it has the ability to influence the way we see things, right? That's the way intuition works. You can't ignore your intuition. It's just there. It's going to affect your perceptions. And even mundane, ordinary insights are coming from this intuitive level of understanding. And they are the result of experience, the kind of experience that makes a deep imprint and alters the way you understand things. That's what an ordinary insight is. And intuitive understanding can be either accurate or false. I suppose you realize that, right? And some people don't realize that, and they think they have an intuition about something, well, it must be true. But our intuitive understanding of the world is false, and it's the problem. And we've talked about that before. You believe that I am this separate self, and that this world is the way it appears to me, and the only way I can be happy and avoid suffering is to manipulate that world. That's our intuitive understanding that we begin with, that is really the cause of all of our problems and all the problems we make for everyone else around us. So when we talk about insight and meditation and sense of the Dharma, we're talking about something that's similar to ordinary insight, in that it is a profound intuitive understanding that is arrived at through experience. But the target of that understanding is very specifically to undo the false intuition that's the basis of how we perceive the world and how we behave. And traditionally, the insights are described as being insight into the three characteristics of human existence, which are basically that anicca, impermanence, which is really not just that things don't last, because that's something that we already understand. But it's really that there are no things. There is only process. There is only change. And our mind, in order to be able to work with the process that we are a part of, divides the world up into things and acts as though those things are real, but they're not really. They're just processes all totally interconnected. And so it's usually described as insight into impermanence, but you can see impermanence isn't really capturing the essence of it. But the first characteristic of everything is that everything is change. There is nothing but change. Okay, so thingness is an illusion. When you have that insight, that comes from experiences of different kinds that really imprint upon you deeply that, in fact, my mind is just making this appearance of stable objects, you know, that there really is no such thing. And when that understanding reaches a deep level and it becomes intuitive knowledge, then it changes the way that you see everything. And so you have that's a super mundane insight into the first of the characteristics of existence. The second characteristic is that all phenomena are devoid of self natures closely related to these. There are no things, only the projections of the mind on the reality that lies behind that. And the insight into impermanence helps us to realize that everything that we see is of this nature. But we can still cling to the idea that we are the exception. I am a self. I am this precious stream of consciousness. There is something about me that's real and substantial, and you know. And so the second characteristic is that is anatta, or no self, which is realizing that just as nothing else in this world has self, or as the way it's sometimes put, just as everything else is empty, so is the self empty. And so that's a profound insight. When you have a cumulative series of experiences that put you face to face with that reality, it's going to have the effect of becoming a deep intuitive knowledge, and you stop experiencing yourself as the real thing that you have always, that your intuitive mind has always assumed it to be and made it appear to be. And then the third characteristic, the third insight is that only suffering can result from the belief that there are things that exist and that I am a self. And that the only path out of suffering is to completely overcome those illusory, mistaken beliefs. So that's the traditional presentation. Insight is insight into the three characteristics. Impermanence, everything is change. No self, the self that I think that I am, it's an illusion. And that clinging to things is real and myself is real is only going to cause suffering. It's always caused suffering, will always cause suffering. And letting go of that clinging is the path to freedom, to liberation. Those are the classic insights. And what they really are, if you think about them, they're overcoming the ignorance that underlies all of our perceptions. What they lead to is, you know, they are transforming in themselves, but as you know, you can have an insight into something. But you can't always necessarily sustain that insight. So you need to, all of these insights need to coalesce into a single, clear, comprehensive understanding. And when that happens, then, you know, then you have achieved the first degree, the first stage of liberation. The purpose of the jhana practice is to achieve that kind of insight, just as the purpose of the Mahamudra practice, and just as the purpose of the Vipassana meditation from the Theravada tradition. That's actually the purpose that underlies all meditation, ultimately. The ultimate purpose of all meditation is to achieve super mundane insight to the degree that it comes together and you have the liberating, the culmination, the liberation. Okay? So, what caused you to ask the question?
Well, because progressing through the jhanas, it's like you're practicing the jhanas. But I wasn't real clear on exactly, I understand what's happening.
Yeah.
But I didn't quite understand where it was supposed to lead to as you make the progression steps in the jhanas.
Yeah. Well, one way of describing where the jhanas are supposed to lead to, and this might be helpful to keep in mind, is that all formations, all formations, we'll use that as a word, both mental of any kind, and if you think about it, you'll come to the conclusion that, well, all formations are actually mental, so you could say all mental formations, but we'll just leave all formations are constantly in a state of flux. So that's the insight into impermanence. Okay. And all formations are associated with suffering in some way or another. And so in these practices of the jhanas, it's a very interesting thing that if you practice the first jhana the way you're supposed to for a while without rushing to the second and the third, you'll reach a place where you're distinctly dissatisfied with a meditation experience that when you first achieved it seemed so incredibly wonderful. Then when you move on to the second jhanas and you practice those, you'll come to exactly the same place that, this is really, it's got to be something better than this. And so you move on to a third jhana. And so this is, you discover that all formations are dissatisfactory. Some extremely so in the form of suffering, and some subtly so, but ultimately they're all dissatisfactory. And then, as you're going through these jhanas, you're also going to be, the mind and our consciousness, this is what we tend to cling to if we start thinking about, well, who am I? What am I? Who am I? Who is this self? You sort of discard, well, I'm not this, and I'm not that, and I'm not my body, and I think I'm my mind. And if you examine that and say, well, you look at the mind closely, you can toss aside pieces of it, and you say, yeah, but I'm this consciousness. That's my true self. And the only way you'll ever know that's not true is when you get the stage of going beyond that. But in this process of practicing the jhanas and essentially discarding all these aspects of your mind, it becomes really clear. It's like peeling the layers off the onion. When the last layer's gone, there's nothing left. There's no essence of onion that's lying in the center that has been, characterizing all the layers all of this time. And so all dhammas, as the proper, all dhammas are devoid of self. But dhammas in that sense refers to mental experiences, all phenomena, all experiential phenomena of any kind, of the most high or of the lowest sort or anything in between, are all ultimately devoid of this core of any kind of self nature. So all dhammas are anatta, but not self. So that's where, and it's good to have that in mind when you're practicing the jhanas. Then you know where you're going and you're more likely to at the right place. An important part of the jhana practice, because especially the first several jhanas they are associated with very sublime. Well, first of all, there's the joy that's intense and exciting, you know, and then there's the happiness, which is more serene and sublime, and then there's the equanimity and tranquility, which is even more sublime still. But an important part of that process is noticing the inevitable tendency. You can't, there's no point trying not to have this happen. The inevitable tendency for your mind to cling to the pleasantness of these things. So you don't try to stop it from happening. You just be aware of it. And you be aware of how that dynamic changes over time. Where you go from clinging to what seems precious to dissatisfaction. And you will, when you practice the jhanas, go through a period where there will be attachment to the pleasure. And some people would have you believe that, well, that's a dangerous thing. That's why you shouldn't practice jhanas, because you'll get attached to the pleasure. But missing the whole point, if you didn't become attached to the pleasure, you can observe it and come out the other side. So it's the path to understanding.
Sounds like you're saying there is nothing.
That there is nothing. Well, yeah, it's so easy for it to sound like that. And that is such an unfortunate thing because, you know, the two extremes that when we speak of this being the middle way, the two extremes are on the one hand, believing that everything exists and I exist. And then the other hand, believing that nothing exists. And they're both tragic mistakes because if, you know, on the one extreme, believing that you exist and everything else exists the way it appears to you, puts you in the state of constantly struggling with a world that, you know, you can't ever really succeed. It's always going to beat you in the end. You're going to get sick and die at the very least. You're going to have lots of troubles in between. And of course, the other extreme is a kind of nihilism, which is very terribly destructive. Although at first it can seem rather liberating, but it leads to some very terrible things because everything loses its meaning. Nothing has meaning if nothing exists. You know, it at first can seem like a relief, and sometimes does. But the longer you stay in that place of nihilism, the more desolate and despairing your experience of reality becomes. But I'm not saying that there's nothing. The opposite is true. And that is the hardest thing to understand, is that there is everything.
There is no thing.
There is no thing. There is no separation. The ultimate nature that we would like to be able to understand is described as suchness, completely undifferentiated, is described as emptiness, which does not mean that nothing exists. It means that no thing exists. It's described as nirvana, and all of these different words are trying to convey the nature of this ultimate reality, which our relationship to is holistic in the sense that we are in every part of it, and every part of it is in us. And the we that we speak of it bears the same relationship to suchness that the wave does to the ocean. And to try to sweep away the waves so that you can see the water is the mistake that we tend to make. And so even if, so one problem that we come to is people will say, oh, it's not that there's nothing, it's everything. And in their mind, this becomes this homogenous pudding of existence, you know, everything's all one. But that's ignoring the fact that inherent in the nature of suchness is the appearance of diversity and multiplicity, which is as much a part of the nature of suchness as is its wholeness, its holisticness, its inseparability into parts. As much as that is its nature, so is this appearance of diversity that we struggle with. And so it's not that nothing exists. It's not that there is nothing. It's that there is everything. And when you lose yourself, you gain everything. But it's not that you become, and this is where analogies fall down. It's not that you become immersed in this vast pudding of existence and beingness, you know, like a drop of water lost in the ocean. You know, you are of the nature of water, which is the nature of the ocean. But the diversity and separateness is a part of that total reality. So it's not a pudding of bland everything the sameness either. It's even more beautiful and magnificent than that. Started your statement.
Oh, I can maybe talk about the Heart Sutra or Palmetto Net. It's always so interesting to me. Oh, I love the words in it.
Yeah.
There is no ear, there is no eye. I mean, all of that.
Well, yes, that's a very profound expression of exactly what we've been talking about. No eye, no ear, no body, no nose, no tongue, nothing to see, nothing to hear, nothing to feel, nothing to taste, nothing to smell. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. That's exactly what we're talking about. It's probably the most elegant attempt that I know of to express what it is we're talking about. But unfortunately, it's so easy to look at the Heart Sutra and say, oh, that means nothing exists. And that's not the idea. But there is nothing. But it's interesting to look at your own experience. And what does it consist of? And if you do that, there's a series of insights that lead up to the big insights that I talked about. And one of the first ones of that is to look at your own mind and look at your own experience as you do in meditation. And you see that your experience consists of two kinds of events. One is sensations, and the other is mental events, thoughts, and images, and emotions, and all that sort of thing. And look as hard as you will, you won't find anything else. Where is the world then? Well, the world is actually a mental construct that your mind has generated based on sensations, but you can't really get beyond the sensations. And this includes your, this is not just the world, but your body. This body by which you experience these sensations you see and you feel and all of these other things, it is also of the same nature of everything else. There are sensations, and on the basis of those sensations, the mind posits the existence of a body of a particular shape and size and characteristics with particular kinds of sense organs. But is there really an eye? Is there really an ear? Well, think about how you go about deciding there's really an ear. You can't see your own ear, but you hear things. But you can see, you can feel your own ear. You can use your hand, which you believe is real, to feel something which seems to be real. But what is there really? Well, it's just sensations. Out of those sensations, and you're constructing the idea of a hand that touches an ear. Your eyes see other people, and you see, and part of the image is formed as ears. But bottom line, if you take it down, there's nothing but sensations, and there's nothing but mental formations that try to make sense of all these sensations. So that's sort of the beginning level basic insight, is that all my experience consists of sensations, and the name for that is rupa. Form, rupa means form, and usually we think of that as being the material universe and materiality and the body and so forth. The first insight is you realize form is nothing but sensations, and everything else about form is a concoction of the mind, which is nama. So nama and rupa, right? So nama is what the mind generates to explain rupa, the sensations that otherwise can't account for it. And that's the first insight. So right there you have, there's no eye, no ear, no tongue, no body. No, anything. The reality is that if you have this insight, then you hear the lines from the Heart Sutra, and it doesn't mean that there's nothing. It's that, yeah, I know what that means. Yeah. Is that my experience is made up of mental activities trying to explain these sensations that I keep experiencing.
As my friends who do neurofeedback say, all neurological.
It's all neurological, yeah. Well, that's the other really interesting thing about it. Is, you know, with Western science, we examine this and say, mind. The mind is just the stuff that the brain does, and the brain is just all these nerve cells and things like that. But when we take this back the other way and say, well, our mind, the idea of brains and nerve cell and everything else is still just the mind trying to explain sensations. With a different kind of mind, we might interpret those sensations differently as something that doesn't even resemble the brain, nerve cells, and so forth. But we're so comfortable with assuming is the underlying reality. Anybody have anything they want to say or ask or comment on? Well, then I'll just ask you, did you find this discussion helpful in any way?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you did?
Especially for a beginner.
How about for some non-beginners?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad. Thank you.
The whole banana. It's all wrong.
Yeah. The whole enchilada. Okay, well, let's take a break before we sit. You might need to use the washroom, and I need to stretch your legs a little bit. So give ourselves about 10 minutes, and then when we come back, we'll sit for 45 minutes, okay? sit for 45 minutes, then we'll do a half an hour walk, and then we'll do another sit that it will be somewhere between half an hour and 45 minutes, depending on unknown factors.
What?
Exactly, depending on that. Yeah.